This show is a Hopful Media podcast production. Hello, everyone. I have been hammering this for the last few episodes now, but Intelligent Speech Online 2026 is almost upon us. It's not too late to get tickets. You can still go to intelligentspeechonline.com and get those. They are $30 unless you use the promo code Persia, in which case they go down by 10% and you can get them for $27. This is an all-day event on February 28th, 2026. It's right around the corner. Events start at 9 a.m. U.S. Eastern Time, and will feature a host of panelists and presenters, including three keynote speakers, including the hosts of Totalis Rankium, The Alternate Historian, and me. I will be presenting as a keynote speaker this year to discuss the companionship and rivalry of the great kings and their own nobility in ancient Persia. I'm very excited for the event this year. It's going to be hosted on Discord. You'll be able to get access to the recordings afterwards if you buy a ticket. And almost every session will end with some sort of Q&A between the podcast hosts that are presenting and you as the audience. It's going to be a good time. We've got a really great lineup this year. I'm very excited. They're very excited. And I have some good friends who have put in a lot of work for this conference, and we really want you all to show up, come to Intelligent Speech Online, wholly digital event. But I understand if you're not sold. So this episode is actually not a podcast episode. It's the audio from my presentation last year. The topic last year was all about deception, so I talked about Darius the Great and how he was a big fat liar. One of my perennial favorite topics, of course. He may or may not be getting a special feature in this year's presentation, too. The one caveat I have for this recording is that I have not edited the audio to flow perfectly as audio, and there was a visual component to the presentation. So if you want to see the full version, I have linked the YouTube video in the description of this episode. But for now, on to the show. Enjoy last year's presentation, and I hope you all come to hear this year's presentation. And again, you can do that by going to intelligentspeechonline.com, ordering your tickets, and getting 10% off with the promo code Persia. I hope to see you there.
Hello, and welcome to this session, Darius the Great Big Liar, with Trevor Cully of History of Persia and America's Secret Wars podcasts. A few things to cover before we begin. I am not Trevor. I am John. I will be helping with tech support and moderating the chat. This session is being recorded. I don't work with Zoom, but if you are having problems, please mention it in the chat, and I will see if I can help. This session will be roughly 20 minutes of presentation, followed by roughly 20 minutes of Q&A. It has a hard stop at 40 minutes, or I will be yelled at. And with that, it gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker. Trevor is a historian and independent researcher dedicated to public presentation of ancient history. He's also the host and producer for History of Persia and the new, slightly more vulgar, America's Secret Wars. When not podcasting, Trevor is also a professional dog walker, cat sitter, apparently I can't speak today, and fuzzy friend petter. History of Persia is a podcast dedicated to the history of Persia, surprise, surprise, and the great empires that ruled there, beginning with the Achaemenid Empire of Cyrus the Great and the foundation of an imperial legacy that directly impacted ancient civilizations from Rome to China, and everywhere in between. He likes pierogi dumplings. Ladies, gentlemen, and other delightful people, Trevor Cully.
Hello, everyone. As said, I am Trevor Cully, the host of History of Persia and America's Secret Wars. I actually announced Secret Wars at the last Intelligent Speech Conference and had every intention of doing something about American history this time. Then they announced the theme was deception, and that plan went out the window because ancient Persian history includes what might just be the greatest lie ever told, or at least the most successful, the official story of Darius the Great's rise to power. If you are not one of my regular listeners, you probably know Darius best from his role in the Battle of Marathon in Greece around 490 BC. But that was actually very early in, or very late in his reign. Uh-oh, I lost my Zoom window. Can somebody put in the chat whether or not they can see my presentation? Excellent. Thank you very much. All right. So today I am actually going back a little over 30 years before the invasion of Greece to explain a story that includes multiple assassinations, evil doppelgangers, questionable family trees, and a gargantuan civil war that spanned the length and breadth of the entire Persian Empire, from the western deserts of Egypt all the way to modern Pakistan and everywhere in between. The story starts somewhere in Central Asia in 530 BCE with the death of Cyrus the Great, the founding conqueror of the Persian Empire, who had taken his people from a provincial vassal state to the rulers of all West Asia in less than 25 years. Different ancient sources tell different versions of the story, but that is the gist of it. Cyrus died while fighting the nomadic Scythians somewhere on his northern borders, and he passed the throne to his elder son, Cambyses. However, one of Cyrus's last acts was also giving his younger son, Bardia, near complete autonomy in the eastern territory of the empire. This worked well enough. We never know much about the Eastern Empire at this time, but Bardia handled all those nomadic horse archers and the northern fringe of the Indus River Valley, while Cambyses focused on expanding in the west, specifically by conquering Egypt. Egypt was having some chaos of its own at the time, and the whole process was over in about 5 years, which was good for Cambyses because he heard some very troubling news. His little brother Bardia seized control of the imperial government and was doing crazy things like canceling taxation, attacking temples, and confiscating the property of the nobility. So Cambyses turned his army around and went home, only to die en route in the middle of Syria. The official Persian record of these events is a giant inscription on a mountain called Behistun, which says that Cambyses, quote, died his own death. Some modern readers interpret this as a thinly veiled assassination, but most of the ancient sources seem to take it as an accident or natural causes, and that seems more likely just because it's probably a nuance of the language we don't understand. That left Cambyses' remaining supporters in a bind, though. With Cambyses dead, Bardia officially declared himself king as his brother's rightful heir, except the nobility hated Bardia. So six of the nobles got to work scheming. One of these six, a guy named Gobryas, also looped in his son-in-law named Darius. Young Darius was a member of Cambyses' personal guard and came from an important noble family called the Achaemenids, distantly related to Cyrus the Great's lineage, supposedly. Darius's father and grandfather were both still alive, but on the far side of the empire, and Darius was in that sweet spot of old enough to be a competent leader, but young enough to listen to his elders. They got in touch with some of their friends still living in Bardia's court and came up with a plan to infiltrate a fortress called Sika Yovaltish near modern Nahaband in Iran. They slipped in, and according to the more detailed Greek accounts, the seven noble hitmen bluffed their way past a couple of courtiers before storming Bardia's bedroom and killing the reigning king of the Persian Empire. Like everyone else, the Greeks tell a couple different versions of what came next, but ultimately Darius was chosen to be king. He then commissioned the Behistun inscription to explain this situation to his subjects, and he had copies distributed far and wide. You see, unbeknownst to anybody at all, Bardia had actually been dead for years, and Cambyses murdered his own brother and employed a scheming magi, a Persian priest who looked like Bardia, to pretend he was the crown prince. This magi was named Gomada, and he had been the one who really stole Cambyses' throne. Very sadly, Darius was the only willing and healthy royal relative left, and thus the proper heir to the empire. Darius even helpfully provides his own genealogy to show that Cambyses and Bardia were his third cousins, and that both of their families descended from Achaemenes, who founded Darius's family name, the Achaemenids. Then this is where the internal logic of the inscription really stumbles. The chaotic transfer of power and Darius's tenuous connection to the royal family was a great opportunity for rebellion. The Behistun inscription at least includes references to 15 revolts and rebel leaders. And the Greek Herodotus actually describes a 16th not included in that official list. Of those 16, only 12 are described in detail at Behistun, and Darius declares each and every rebel leader a liar, apparently suggesting they all assumed false identities, just like Gomada. Depending on how you read it, you could see this as most of them lying about being king because Darius was the real king, but several of them are explicitly identified with quote-unquote real names. For example, Vahya's Dada, who led the Persian home province in a rebellion against Darius, declared himself to be the real Bardia. The 12 revolts mentioned at Behistun were put down over the course of 522 to 519 BC, while several of them are not described in detail, which might have lasted until more like 515 or even 510. It was a very chaotic start to Darius's reign. It's a story that sounds unbelievable, and yet it's not contested at all by ancient sources. Usually, when a government official proclaims this kind of incredible story, somebody else records a more believable alternative. The Greco-Roman historians Herodotus, Ctesias, Xenophon, and Pompeius Trogus span time from a generation after Darius's life to almost 500 years later, and each of those four had their own distinct sources for Persian history. Yet all four of them tell stories that closely reflect the Behistun inscription with more or less embellishment. Then you have us modern historians, who universally believe that Darius was a liar. The whole thing is too unrealistic to be believable in the first place. But when it's the only story going around, it's the only one that gets recorded. The trick is, modern researchers can take the entire corpus of information that has survived from ancient Persia and compare it in a way that nobody would have been able to at the time. When we do that, some suspicious flaws become obvious in Darius's version of events. There's also the small issue of applying even a tiny bit of logic to the whole "the prince was replaced by an evil magician" idea. As a start, if we follow Herodotus, then Bardia actually went with Cambyses to Egypt, hinted at rebellion there, and was assassinated for it. Only then was Gomata brought in to replace him. That timeline doesn't even work, and there's not enough room for everyone to get between locations, so Darius's original chronology, where Bardia was murdered before Cambyses left, is more realistic but still fantastical. Even then, we are being asked to believe that nobody in the royal court noticed or acted on the fact that the crown prince had been replaced by a priest for almost 7 years. This works well enough for the general public, most servants and even noble visitors. It was the 6th century BC. It's not like they had pictures. But Darius wants us to believe that nobody reacted, including people like Bardia's wife, daughter, sisters, lifelong friends, personal bodyguards, and servants. He does say that Gomata killed many people who knew the real Bardia, but we also know quite a lot of them were still alive later. Then there are the odd details in Darius's genealogy. He claimed that he was a third cousin to the recently deceased royal brothers, and that they were all members of the Achaemenid family. The ancient sources that describe Cyrus the Great and his sons as Achaemenids are mostly Greek, which also draw on Behistun, and a couple of very small inscriptions at Cyrus's palace at Pasargadae, written in Old Persian cuneiform, which simply say, "I am Cyrus the King, an Achaemenid." The issue here is that most modern scholars don't think Old Persian cuneiform was invented before Cyrus died. In the Behistun inscription, Darius declared, "By the grace of Ahura Mazda, this inscription which I have made, it was written in the Arya script, and it was composed on clay tablets and on parchment." Arya, in this case, is often translated as Aryan, and it just means Iranian. And the Arya script is what we usually call Old Persian. It's just a bit unusual to call this much attention to how you wrote the inscription inside the text. But aside from those inscriptions at Pasargadae, no other Old Persian inscription is reliably dated to before Darius's reign. This has led many historians and epigraphists to think that Darius actually had the Old Persian system invented for creating his monuments, and then retroactively applied it to some of Cyrus's palaces. In the genealogy that Cyrus the Great presents himself, with the so-called Cyrus Cylinder in Babylon, he only traces his lineage back to Thespes, the son of Achaemenes, who Darius also lists as their most recent ancestor. Many moderners question this. If the family name was Achaemenid, then why didn't Cyrus include another generation? A lot of modern historians think Darius wedged Thespes into his own family tree and was lying about being related to Cyrus and his children at all. I personally remain skeptical of that claim. We don't know enough about Persian clan names and family structure to understand who was supposed to identify with which ancestor. Thespes was also the first member of the family to rule over the Elamite city of Anshan, which would be much more important to Cyrus's Babylonian audience than some old Persian chieftain who they had never heard of. Either way, Darius's claim to legitimacy here is very weak. If he was lying about being related, he didn't do a good job. If he wasn't lying about that, he almost certainly was lying about being the most legitimate heir. As a third cousin, it is an incredible stretch of logic to believe that a royal family didn't have any living male lineage relatives more closely related than Darius and his immediate ancestors. That would mean that any and all of Cyrus the Great's brothers, uncles, and great uncles did not have male descendants, and that every single man in Darius's branch going back three generations was an eldest son, or at least the eldest with male heirs. It is technically possible, but it is extremely unlikely. More realistically, Darius was the closest male relative in on the conspiracy to assassinate Bardia, or Gomata, if you want to take it that way. It's all made even less believable by Darius's insistence throughout the inscription that everyone who opposed him was also lying about their identity in some way. Like I said before, it could be a way of saying they weren't legitimate because Darius was the only true king. Ultimately, the whole inscription is just propaganda to justify an assassination and a coup to make Darius the ruler after a grueling civil war. And that brings me to the last element of Darius's deception, his religious angle. The Behistun inscription was the first time that a Persian king invoked the Zoroastrian god Ahura Mazda in a monument. Until the 1970s, this was frequently used as evidence that Darius undertook some sort of religious reformation and converted his entire empire to Zoroastrianism. This partially framed the Behistun revolts as a war of religion. But that way of looking at things has largely fallen by the wayside. There aren't any earlier inscriptions about Ahura Mazda because there aren't any earlier Iranian inscriptions at all. However, Behistun, more than any other Achaemenid royal monument, brings up Ahura Mazda a lot. Darius was clearly trying to claim a sort of divine right to rule here, and that's also why he is so insistent that all of his opponents are liars. The old Persian word for I lie is adarugia. A lie itself is droga. Droga is also their word for the Zoroastrian religious concept of druge. It's usually translated as the lie, but it means a lot more than that. The lie is a cosmic disorder. It is everything antithetical to truth and righteousness in the universe. It's not just dishonesty, it's inherently evil. But that evil was a product of deceptive spiritual forces. So when Darius says something like, when Cambyses had departed into Egypt, the people became hostile and the lie multiplied in the land, the lie is the spiritual corruption. When he says, Gomata lied to the people saying, I am Bardia, the son of Cyrus, it implies that Bardia was lying about his identity and spreading spiritual corruption. And this phrasing, a rebel king lied to the people saying, I am false name or title, repeats for each enemy Darius describes in the text. Ironically, many of the rebels that historians can see in the Behistun inscription are called liar kings, but they were generally attempting to reclaim the old Median and Babylonian empires from before Cyrus the Great's conquests. And many of them have entirely realistic connections to those dynasties' deposed rulers. With so many of his claims in doubt, or just outright lies, it would be fair to call Darius the liar king. And yet, his campaign of propaganda was so successful that no surviving source ever calls him out. and his name and message became forever tied to an illegitimate ruler's search for legitimacy. A few generations later, a younger prince named Ochus declared himself Darius II and fought two of his elder brothers for power. He even republished the Behistun inscription for his own time period. And the final king of the Persian Empire came to the throne as a distant cousin of the royal family after a series of assassinations. And he was Darius III. Yet, they were all Achaemenids. Darius's lie was so effective that it not only wasn't debated, it was embraced and became the only story for a couple thousand years. Thank you very much, everybody. I think we can switch over to the Q&A portion now.
Wow, yeah, thank you very much. That was really interesting. Cool, so we've got a couple of questions in the chat already from David Montgomery. David's first question: what would be the tell on your podcast if you had been murdered and replaced by an evil magi?
If I had been murdered by an evil magi, well, it would probably be a change in all of the weird idiosyncrasies in the way I talk. Maybe fewer smash cuts between different takes in the audio.
Yeah, it's the little things that make us stand out from the AI. Second question, also from David. Do the Persians have any suggestions for defeating Draugr, this cosmic lie? Asking for a friend's country, apparently.
Yes, they had Arta, or Asha, the cosmic truth. The way that you did that was by following the tenets of Zoroastrianism. Though if you start digging into that, you might find that it's harder to figure out what exactly those were, depending on who you ask. So no easy answers, I'm afraid.
Fair. Question from, Martin Evans says that was really interesting. Thank you. Elio asks, are there any good AI-generated images of places like Persepolis?
There really are not. It's AI images seem to struggle quite a lot with ancient history. I think in part because either they're working off of older artists' renderings of it in illustrations that are based on misconceptions or pop culture in some way, or they're working off of stone reliefs and photographs of monuments that AI doesn't process very well. There are some great full color recreations of Persepolis that were associated with the Getty Pavilion in Los Angeles, but I don't know if they're still up online. Though I will say regarding AI that something it really struggles with dealing with ancient history is chariots. There are surprisingly few pieces of art out there depicting chariot battles in the Achaemenid period or later in the Hellenistic period. And I have tried to use AI to get something like that, and it tends to replace people's legs with wheels or literally put the cart before the horse.
Hey, maybe I know something we don't. Next question from Greg Gassman. This may be a difficult one, but what are the tenets of Zoroastrianism? Don't worry, I think he wasn't entirely serious in that question, yeah. By which I mean he put he was kidding.
Greg, please don't do this to me. We'll be here for another 45 minutes. But I can give the very basics of the threefold path of Zoroastrianism, which is to have good thoughts, speak good words, and do good deeds. And that is kind of the foundational ethos and mantra that ties it all together.
Sounds like quite nice words to live by. Alan asks, how far is the lack of opposing views down to a lack of sources for the period generally?
It's really not. In part because we have a number of other historians who I didn't list who also describe these events. They just seem to be referencing either the same or similar information to Herodotus, Pompeius, Xenophon, and Theseus. Those four just seem to be the ones with very distinct, separate sources of information. But this is something that is referenced by most ancient historians who talk about the time period, and many of them reference other sources who were lost to us. So if there was some kind of compelling, competing option, it almost certainly would have made it into one of those surviving texts, especially someone like Plutarch, who is extremely critical of some of the more fantastical elements of Herodotus, but doesn't have a counter argument to the Behistun story because there wasn't one in circulation.
That's very interesting. Thank you. Alan also asked, did the Greeks challenge Darius's legitimacy as a way of encouraging his nobles to rebel?
Not so far as we know. The Greeks didn't really get involved with Darius the Great that much. There were the Greeks in Anatolia, modern Turkey, who were already subjects from Cyrus the Great's time, and they rebelled and kind of dragged Athens into the conflict without any real political knowledge of what was going on over there. Like, they knew a big kingdom from far to the east had taken everything over, but they didn't really understand the geography of it as they would later when they had interacted with the Persians more. And they had just sort of started interacting with Greece and Persia during Darius's reign.
Thank you. William Winkus, thanks you for the good presentation. It was very interesting. I actually have a question from me, if I may. You said that Darius's descent from the Achaemenids was tenuous at best, so it was a bit odd that he lied about it in the first, as in, if it was a lie, it wasn't a good one. If you were going to pretend to be the last surviving descendant of a dynasty, what sort of lie would you tell?
Oh, I would go further back. It works differently in the modern world where we don't have a ton of big important dynasties hanging around anymore. So today you can just trace things back to a point where everybody loses track of your ancestry and just make up a couple of people in the middle until you connect back to some established historical figures. In Darius's case, I would have recommended, either addressing where all of his cousins went or just kind of going with a dynastic change and just declaring you're focusing so much on the favor of Ahura Mazda in the inscription already. Just say Ahura Mazda didn't like them anymore.
Yeah. I'll bear that in mind next time I try and cause a dynastic change. Martin Kroninger asks, in which way do you mean that Darius invented the Persian cuneiform writing? Could you expand on that, please?
Yes. So there are a very small number of inscriptions from ancient Iran from ancient Persia, because ancient Iran includes Elam, which had its own very complex cuneiform system. But there are very few Persian inscriptions which claim to be older than the Behistun inscription. Most of them are attributed to Darius's ancestors in the text and were found on gold plates in the city of Ecbatana, modern Hamadan. But they all contain grammatical errors that are very characteristic of the late Achaemenid period. So they were probably created as showpieces at some later date. And then there's the Cyrus ones that I talked about. So there's no evidence of the Persian cuneiform system prior to Darius's lifetime that can, at least not that can be reliably dated or that was used anywhere. It seems odd that Cyrus would come up with a new writing system and then use it to write about two sentences. So the thought among a lot of historians and scholars of writing is that Darius commissioned his scribes to create a simple, easy to learn pseudo-alphabetic script that would match the style of the existing cuneiform languages around them and bring Persian up to the prestige and social class of some of the neighboring cultures.
That's very interesting. Thank you. And Zoe agrees. Loved your presentation. Very informative and interesting. Follows up with a question. Is there any evidence, or is it plausible, that at least some or even just one of the rebels Darius defeated were genuinely imposters, i.e. they weren't who they claimed to be?
Yes. There is one. Let me double check his name to make sure I get the pronunciation right. But the second rebel at Babylon, who claimed the throne name Nebuchadnezzar, was actually Araka and Armenian, the son of Haldita. And he's a very interesting case because clearly an Armenian was not a legitimate successor to the Chaldean dynasty that ruled Babylon before Cyrus the Great's time. The thing is, Darius had just defeated an Armenian rebellion in the years leading up to this second revolt in Babylon. So it's entirely likely that this Araka was somebody from the Armenian leadership that fled from Darius and kind of snuck around behind the Persian army while they were distracted with the other rebellions to try and claim a slice of empire for himself. So at that point, it really is just some warlord trying to carve out a piece of territory.
Thank you very much. This one's from me. You mentioned that this kind of religious prescription of lying, which I suppose isn't that, you know, uncommon. Ben was talking in the opening notes about the Abrahamic religion concept of bearing false witness. Do you think, though, that would have given Darius an edge in that people might not have expected him to make such a brazen lie?
It certainly could be part of it, especially because he is framing everything in that religious context. But I think it's also worth noting that when there is this religious prohibition against lying in Zoroastrianism, it is very focused on that kind of spiritual deception, trying to sway people to the side of evil and wrongdoing, not necessarily just being truthful about everything, which is how a lot of ancient Greek sources tended to interpret that. The Persian royalty and later on in the Sassanid period, when we have more Zoroastrian priests in the historical record, they lied all the time. They knew how to use lies to gain political power, to sway their enemies, or to trick their opponents in battle. There were good reasons to lie. There were acceptable reasons to lie. But they also had the concept of kvarena, which was, you could essentially read it as a divine right to rule. So what Darius is claiming here is that he and his family, which includes Bardia, or the real Bardia, and Cambyses, had the Kiverena, and these people were all embracing the lie in a spiritual sense by denying that.
Oh, yeah, that's a pretty huge lie.
I said with Greg, I can get into as much Zoroastrianism as people want, but it is a really complex topic to come at from different random angles.
Absolutely. We're nearly out of time, but there may be room for one more. Elio asks, could you speak more about the hose of lies one gets taken to in the Zoroastrian religion? This was interesting in your podcast.
Yeah, I think it is a type, at least a typo or a misspeak on my part, for the House of Lies. It is, roughly speaking, the Zoroastrian equivalent to hell. It is where, when you are judged at the time of your death, people who committed more evil or accepted more lies in their lifetime
are taken for their afterlife. And in Zoroastrian apocalyptic literature, it is not a fiery place inherently, but is a place that will be cleansed with fire during the end times. So it's kind of a holding cell, if you will, for people who sinned too much in life.
Thank you very much. Sorry, that was actually supposed to be house, by the way. So I apologize for weakening for saying it wrong. But thank you very much, Trevor. Thank you very much to our audience. Trevor, if you have any closing remarks?
I will be back for presentations throughout the day. So I hope to continue seeing people at the Call My Bluff and the Pen Names panel and the Religion panel. I will be around. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a lovely day, everybody. See you all at more of the sessions.
If you want more information about this podcast, you can go to hopfulmedia.com. That's where you'll find things like my bibliography, episode imagery, and additional resources. If you want to hear more of my voice, you can listen to America Secret Wars, where I tell my friends and guests the story of forgotten and overlooked conflicts in American history. And if you want to support my projects, you can go to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merch, or subscribe to get access to ad-free listening and bonus content. If you don't want to spend money on me, that's absolutely fine. The best ways to support a project like this are to share on social media or leave reviews on your podcast app of choice. So review on Apple, rate on Spotify, and you can find me on Blue Sky at History of Persia and on Instagram at History of Persia Podcast. Until next time, thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia.